Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Lung Pa asked me to give the talk tonight, so I came down for tea time, hoping to sit in and hunt for some themes. Not quite sure what to talk about. So a few things came up during tea time. One that struck me was the 10 people's tendency to do something just by virtue of having done it for a long time already, or to walk down a path that might not be right, but just to keep going that direction, just because one's been going that direction for so long, it might as well just keep going that way, even if it's wrong. And it reminds me of a Native American saying that I read once. There's, if you're walking down a path, when you realize it's the wrong path, no matter how far you've gone, turn back. So it's like that in practice. If you've held a view, it might be a wrong view. If you've held your whole life, and you realize it's a wrong view, then move away from it. It doesn't matter how long it's been held on to, or there's some sort of grudge or attachment. And so that really ties into right view as well. So it's, and also the practice of just shifting our perceptions and shifting our mind into align with the teaching of the Buddha and the Dhamma, right view. And to always take responsibility for our own feelings and our own emotions, our own mental states, what's coming up. It's so easy to always put it externally or blame something outside of ourselves. Yesterday, somebody told me, I can feel your anger, and I was actually in quite a peaceful, happy mental state, and I wasn't quite sure what they were talking about, but I thought, well, I agree that you're feeling something, but even if I was angry, you probably wouldn't be feeling my anger. If I'm angry, I'm gonna feel it, it's unpleasant, and or it's just so easy to say somebody did something to me a long time ago, and I know their intention was this or that, and maybe there's a grudge held on to for a really long time, maybe a number of years, and then finally decide to approach that person. Well, what was going through your mind when you said that to me or did that to me? And it might be completely different than what we had assumed all those years. And yet, it's going to be really hard to let go of just by virtue that we've held on to that grudge or that attachment for so many years already. We might find out that that person was completely innocent and didn't even mean to harm us, but just could have been a slip of the tongue or just something. They'd had no bad intention at all, but still, the tendency will be there to keep holding on to that grudge, keep holding on to that attachment just because it's been held on to for so long. Or we might even justify it, like, they told me that, but they must be lying, or they must, I'm absolutely sure that they did have a bad intention. I'm absolutely sure they were angry at me. And we convince ourselves of things. I think that's a function of wrong view, is to convince ourselves of things that are false. And then the mind is always going up and down all the time. And the way we tie ourselves to conditions is really interesting. We get some praise, the mind feels happy. Some criticism, the mind feels sad or angry. And it just goes up and down like that. We get given something, feel happy. Get something taken away, something stolen, lose something, and feel sad when we tie our mind to those conditions. We're taking refuge in conditions. And that's really what it boils down to with birth and death. We tie our mind to conditions, we're tying our mind to birth and death, and that's really what's keeping the cycle going. But any time we can come back to knowing those conditions. And so it's like Master Hua would say, according with conditions, we do not change. We do not change, but we accord with conditions. And so it's not pushing conditions away, we're acknowledging conditions. And we're learning from the conditioned world, and we need to do things like keep precepts and practice meditation, and the mind has to be still enough to develop wisdom and to even remember to be mindful or to return to the knowing. And so those are all conditions. The Noble Eightfold Path is the highest of all conditions. But yet remembering not to take refuge in conditions, and that ultimately birth and death are conditions. And that's what we're taking refuge in. That's what we're tying ourselves to. And so with right view, stepping back from conditions, no matter how extreme they may be, we may have, something extreme may have happened. Somebody may have yelled at us or even hit us. And so those are getting into more extreme conditions, and emotions are going to come up. There's conditioning from our lifetime. There's going to be a reaction. The mind's going to react in various ways. Emotions are going to come up. But even still, even if we're getting emotional, it is possible to step back from that and kind of remembering this story of Ajahn Chah, where he was driven to tears in his practice, and yet he still stepped back from that, and he was telling himself, just let the tears dry up, just let them run themselves out. And he was kind of telling himself this, but at the same time he was in the middle of this intense emotional state of feeling lonely, feeling sorry for himself, and yet still able to use the practice to step back from that and to know how that felt, to completely be present for it. I remember at Pujum Gom in 2011, on October 31st, 2011, I dislocated my shoulder at Pujum Gom, and it was the way they put it back in at the hospital in Ubon was quite rough and not very well done, and so it wasn't healing very well, and maybe a month or two after the shoulder was put back in, I went with some of the lay people from Pujum Gom and visited my friend Ajahn Achalo at Anandagiri just to get some time away and some downtime and change of scenery for a week or two, and a lot of gratitude to Tana Soko, who was there at the time, my friend in Thailand, very tall Swiss monk, was an osteopath before he ordained, and he did some work on my shoulder and really helped it out quite a bit. I was bearing up with it, but he did some work which caused a lot of numbness to disappear, and I could move it more freely, and it started to heal much better after that. But still, it was a kind of a serious injury, so it was still healing very slowly. and the months were going by, it wasn't really getting better. And then December rolled around, and Lungpa Pasano visiting Thailand, and I was keen on trying to get him out to Pujumgam. I knew he hadn't been there in a few years. And so it's early January, he was going to be able to come out for a few days. So I was really happy about that. And Tansen Bajano was his attendant at the time. So I was at Pujumgam by myself for a couple weeks during that period, because there was a lot of things happening at Wat Nanachat. They were preparing for, I think it might have been the 20th anniversary of Lungpa Cha's passing. And so it's going to be a big deal. And the monks at Nanachat were preparing for that. And I was just at Pujumgam, looking after Pujumgam on my own for a couple weeks. So I thought, oh, this is going to be really nice. Lungpa's coming with Tansen Bajano, and just have a quiet couple of days. And they were going to be showing up on the Uposatha day. But I thought, oh, three bhikkhus, we only do Padimokkha if we have four. And so I thought, oh, it's going to be a nice quiet evening. We just do a very short 5-minute ceremony when there's only three bhikkhus. We don't have to chant the 45-minute Padimokkha. And so, but my arm was still in quite a lot of pain, and I was wearing a sling on and off to rest my left arm, my left shoulder. And there needed to be some kuti preparation, cleaning up around the main area. So I just spent the entire day mostly just using one arm, cleaning the monastery. And I moved out of the kuti I was in so Lungpa could stay there, because that's the nicest kuti down in the main area. And I moved onto a little tudong platform that I would stay on from time to time. And so I was cleaning the kuti up, and going quite slow, one-armed, and cleaning the sala, kind of sweeping up around the area. And then kind of evening came around, and at the last minute, a senior monk wanted to come along with Lungpa and Tansen Bajano, so that was going to make four. So I thought, oh, we're going to have to chant Padimokkha. And I was the only Padimokkha chanter. So I thought, well, you know, okay, I'll have to do that. And but by the end of the day, I was quite exhausted. And so we went into the sala, had tea, had juice, and chatted for a bit. And I knew Lungpa was really tired from when he's in Thailand. He tends to always be at the state of like staggering or like almost falling over with exhaustion. And so I knew he was really tired. So, but I thought, okay, well, we're going to have to do the Padimokkha now because there's four of us. So, and I wasn't really that out of practice, but I was very, very tired and in quite a bit of pain by that point. And so, it was getting late. So we thought, okay, we better chant the Padimokkha. And so I got through the first maybe 10 minutes or so of the Padimokkha, and then I just started really stumbling with it. And this other senior monk who came, he was checking, because he could also chant Padimokkha, but he hadn't done it in a really long time, and he didn't think he would be able to do it. And so he was checking, and then I started kind of making a lot of mistakes, and he was kind of getting more and more irritated. And then it was just like, just read it. And so he just handed me the book, and I didn't chant it from memory then. From that point, I just read it, and it was quite embarrassing for me. And I never had to do that before. And so I started feeling kind of down on myself, quite bad about this. And then also I felt kind of bad because I knew how tired Lungpa was. So then I ended up reading the Padimokkha, got to the finish, and then everybody was able to go and retire. It was maybe 10 p.m. or so by that time. And then this senior monk pulled me aside afterwards, and he was telling me things like, that was really shameful, I know this can happen. You forget the Padimokkha when you're living on your own. But I was thinking to myself, I hadn't chanted the Padimokkha that long ago before then, but I was just so tired, and my mind just kind of stopped working. And so, but I didn't tell him that, and wasn't trying to make excuses, but I was kind of starting to get really hard on myself and like, oh, this is too much. So then Tansa Majano came back and he said, Longpa's going to bathe and he doesn't have a towel. And so I was thinking, oh no, I didn't prepare the kuti properly. So I was getting more hard on myself then. So we got a towel and then I went back to my platform, and it was cold season. So there was cold winds kind of starting to blow in. It was getting quite chilly and I didn't really have a good blanket on the platform. But I was already really tired and really starting to feel depressed. And then I was thinking, oh, you know, everything, I'm just exhausted, in pain, it's cold, receiving a lot of criticism and embarrassed. And then I just completely broke down and just started weeping just bitterly. And so right away though, I thought of Lungpo Cha having this experience, which I was kind of having that moment, just feeling so utterly sorry for myself and just so caught in it, but then at the same time able to step back. And so I just told myself, I said, okay, just be like Ajahn Chah, just let the tears just go until they're just gone. And that didn't make the condition go away, but at the same time being able to step back and watch it as well and not be completely lost in it, but having that sense of knowing it and knowing what's happening. And so that doesn't make it stop, but the tears ran themselves out 30 minutes, 45 minutes. And I kind of felt better after that. Yeah, the next day I had to see that senior monk again who had criticized me, and I was kind of despondent when I was around him. I felt like, okay, this is practice. This is something which, you know, reflecting on it now, I feel good having gone through things like that. You know, I could have taken it another way and just gotten more and more depressed. That would be just getting lost in conditions. You know, or saying like, that senior monk was responsible for the way I was feeling then, but really reflecting on it, it's, you know, things I was telling myself and little wrong views, they crop up in the mind and they're hard to see sometimes. So the way we relate to ourselves, like in that experience I had, is thinking like, you know, I'm useless as a monk, or, you know, I should have chanted the Padimokkha better, and it, just sense of self coming up really strong. And so that's just how wrong view comes up. It's the sense of self I was. You know, we've defined ourselves maybe our whole life a certain way, or everybody thinks of me that way, therefore I am that way. And defining ourselves in a certain way or defining others. Maybe we've thought of someone else or ourselves in such a way for such a long time, it's really hard to change it. We've walked down that path for so long, it's not going to be easy to turn back. I have the feeling we might need to walk a long way back just to get on the right path again, but that's really what we have to do with practice. So my kuti today, this afternoon, also reading over a sutta on the gradual path, and it's the, I think it's called the Gopaka Moggallana Sutta, and it's Gopaka Moggallana, a Brahmin, approaching the Buddha and saying that, you know, archers have a gradual path by which they learn archery, horsemen have a gradual path by which they learn horsemanship, elephant riders have a gradual path, charioteers have a gradual path, and so on. And so he said, does the Blessed One have a gradual path, which he teaches to his monks? And then, so the Buddha goes through the gradual path, first restraint according to the Patimokkha, and then going on from there is sense restraint, moderation in eating, commitment to wakefulness, and then on to abandoning the five hindrances and into the four jhanas and right concentration. But what struck me is then after that, Gopaka Moggallana asks the Buddha, so do all of your bhikkhus, thus having heard this gradual path spoken by the Blessed One, do they all attain arhantship? And then the Buddha responds by saying, some attain arhantship and some don't. And then, of course, Gopaka Moggallana saying, why do some not attain arhantship? And then the Buddha giving the analogy of the road, just say you want to go to Rajagaha and you're pointing the path out to somebody. You have to go to this city first, then turn right at this city, and then turn left at this junction, and you get to Rajagaha. And so somebody following that path exactly as it was laid out will get to Rajagaha. But if somebody takes a wrong turn and gets onto a wrong path at any of those points along the way, then they won't make it. So, and they'll have to turn back. They'll have to turn back and get back onto the right path. And so the bhikkhus who they take on the Patimokkha Sila, practicing sense restraint, but not moderate eating, not committed to wakefulness, and so on, or some part of that gradual path has been followed incorrectly, then they won't make it to arhantship. Another good point to make, I think, is that if we see that we're on a wrong path, then to just be able to turn back and get on a right path and not to be too hard on ourselves or you know, create a self about me being, you know, always wrong or on the wrong, always going the wrong way, always messing up. And it just takes a long time to align all of our perceptions with right view, with right practice. And depending on each individual's karma and tendencies and conditioning, you know, it can take a really long time. I like to think of experiences in practice like where the one where I was at Pujumgam and just being in pain and feeling sorry for myself and being driven to tears by that that's how difficult it is to learn how to shift our perceptions. We really have to have things like that happen where we're testing the edge or going beyond the boundaries that we impose on ourselves all the time. And just being willing to move towards the edge of our comfort zone and allowing ourselves to go outside of boundaries that we normally would stay inside of in the practice. You know, trying to sleep a little bit less, trying to eat a little bit less. Dare to speak less. Try to not talk during bowl washing. That's who's willing to go there these days? You know, eating little, speaking little, sleeping little. This is what the Krubhajans are teaching. So are we willing to go there? We may have spent our entire monastic life here, or our entire time as a layperson or as a guest here, say, talking during the meal cleanup. And so just being willing or daring enough to try it out, try not talking during the meal cleanup. Give oneself that opportunity to cultivate mindfulness while cleaning things and to do a good, thorough job. Usually when we're talking, then we're not being mindful. It's a distraction. A lot of times I've noticed when the bowls or things clank together in the monk's room, it's because someone's talking and not paying attention. And so just giving oneself the opportunity to be mindful, to pay attention to what one is doing. It's a really precious and rare opportunity. Or say, eating little, just we don't have to be, you know, fasting or, you know, shriveling up or eating too little, but just just weaning ourselves off that sense of indulgence. And so the heart is cool during the meal. And the food is like medicine for the body. And then eating mindfully, it doesn't have to be overly slow, but just eating our food mindfully and carefully, knowing how certain foods affect us, and not stuffing ourselves too full, but just eating that which is just right, or, you know, slightly less of what we would think is just right, and then filling the rest of our stomach up with our drink. Then the mind is bright after the meal, and you won't be really drowsy. Or if there is a lot of drowsiness after the meal, just being willing to experiment and eat a little bit less. Counting bites can be a good practice depending on the person. Just saying, oh, you know, how many bites are just right for me? Or if counting bites isn't your practice, then just contemplating, yeah, this is food, this is the earth element. And so not getting lost in the taste or intoxicated by the food, but just recollecting earth element. And this is just medicine, sustenance for the body. Once it's in the stomach, the taste is gone. And so moderation in eating. And that leads right into commitment to wakefulness or sleeping little. Because we don't overeat, we're usually not... There might be a little bit of drowsiness as the food is digesting after the meal, but if we haven't overeaten, the drowsiness isn't going to be so extreme that it's overpowering. Yeah, just commitment to wakefulness. We have a good structure for that already here at Abhayagiri. Morning puja, having to get up and come to morning puja. And so we have a structure which is already, say, in line with commitment to wakefulness. Evening puja, meditation, going up and maybe not going to sleep right away at one's cabin, but just trying to stay up for a little bit. It doesn't have to be a long time. I remember asking Lungpa Liam, because for myself, I really swing back and forth. Like, I'll think, I need, okay, 4 hours a night sleep, and then I'll try that few days. I'll just be completely wasted, and okay, I need a little bit more than that. 5 hours, 6 hours, you know. If it's not winter retreat, you know, try to be sleeping 6 hours. But always telling myself, like, you know, that's just too much. That's too indulgent. That's not commitment to wakefulness. So I remember asking Lungpa Liam, it wasn't even really in relation to commitment to wakefulness, but it was just, I asked him, what do you think a good aditan for me would be? And right away he said, just don't ever go to sleep before 9 p.m. That's one I think you can keep. I thought, oh, that's interesting. Okay, that's middle way. That's doable. He didn't say sleep 4 hours a night. He didn't give something really concrete like that, but he said, when you go to bed, no matter how tired you are, make sure it's not before 9 p.m. And so, yeah, I think that's one I feel that I'm able to keep. Get to my kuti before 9 p.m., or maybe there's no evening puja that night. Tired, maybe been working, want to lie down right away. No, let's just wait till 9 p.m. It might be only 8 p.m. or 7 p.m. Let's just stay up and read suttas or meditate, and you might be a bit tired, but no problem. So commitment to wakefulness, eating little, speaking little, sleeping little, being willing to push those boundaries a little bit. Yeah, we also do that on the weekly Wanpra. It's the structure is there for it. Being willing to push the boundaries a bit. So yeah, right view, not being afraid to turn back from wrong paths, going on to right paths, pushing the boundaries. I think I'll just leave it there for this evening. Namah Shivaya.